so is
not testing all this stuff out early enough. Zeus was mad at two brothers, Prometheus and Epimetheus, because they had shirked their responsibilities and had gone and done something that, well, they would regret later. Zeus and the other gods had given these two brothers the job of giving gifts to all of the creatures on earth. And it turns out that they went through and gave great gifts to all the creatures until they got to mankind. When they got to mankind, they realized, oops, we're out of gifts. And they said, this just isn't right. This isn't good enough. We can't have the God's greatest creation, man, not have a gift. What should we do? So Prometheus snuck up to Mount Olympus and stole fire from Zeus and came down and gave it to man. And up there on Mount Olympus, Zeus looked down and saw fire all over the place and said, this just isn't right. This isn't the way that I wanted things. And he got mad. So he decided he was going to punish Prometheus, and he was going to punish Epimetheus and man for accepting the gift of fire. So to Prometheus, Zeus came and took him up on top of a mountain and strapped him to a rock. And he sent an eagle. And the eagle came down and ate Prometheus' liver. And every night, his liver would grow back. And every day, Zeus would send the eagle back to eat his liver. Ugh. But what he had in mind for Epimetheus and for mankind was even worse. See, Zeus, he was a crafty, crafty guy. And when he punished Epimetheus and mankind, well, here's what he did. In order to punish Epimetheus, he sent him women. Actually, a woman. I didn't write the story, I'm just telling you. He sent him a specific woman. And he made this woman and had each of the other gods give her a specific gift. She was beautiful, she was talented, she was smart. And he named her Pandora and sent her down, and she met Epimetheus, and the two fell in love. That was just the beginning of Zeus's plan. The second part of Zeus's plan happened when he sent his messenger, Mercury, down to meet this happy couple. Mercury went down to meet them, and he had a box with him. When he ran into Epimetheus and Pandora, he was tired and out of breath and exhausted. And he said to the couple, can you guys help me out? I've got to deliver this box for Zeus, and I just can't get it done today. Can I drop it off at your house, and then I'll come back and pick the box up and finish my delivery? And they said, absolutely. You know, Zeus was mad at me, Epimetheus said. Zeus was mad at me, but he gave me this woman. I fell in love, so think things are going better. I don't want to do anything to mess that up. So whatever Zeus needs, he's got it. Mercury went to the house, dropped off the box, and left. Didn't say another word. And as Epimetheus and Pandora sat there in the house, they kept looking at that box, saying, what do you think was so important that Mercury had this journey that he had to go on? What do you think's in that box? And finally, Pandora said to Epimetheus, I need to know what's in that box. Epimetheus said, Pandora, listen, we can't do that. We shouldn't do that. Zeus is trusting us here. Mercury's trusting us. Let's not do that. And Pandora said, I didn't say I want to know what's in the box. I said I need to know what's in the box, and I'm going to find out. You can't stop me. And here is where we find the very dastardly part of the second part of Zeus's plan. Because in that box, Zeus had placed all of the evil things that now plague mankind. And when Pandora went over and reached down and opened the lid of the box, they all started to spring out before she could do anything to stop them. So out jumped hatred, out jumped greed, out jumped envy, out jumped lust. And finally, she slammed the top of the box down, but these things had already escaped into the world. There was only one thing left in the box, one of these evil things that Zeus had placed in the box. Now it was hope. That's the way that the Greeks wrote this mythical story. included among all those other things, those evil things, Zeus had placed hope. Now, eventually Pandora opened the box again and hope came out and people felt better for a while. And that's why the Greeks put hope in with these other things, because to them, hope was a fleeting thing. It could make you feel better for a while, but didn't really make a difference. It was fake. It was false. When Stephen King wrote the short story that would lead to The Shawshank Redemption, he said that hope is a dangerous thing. There he was talking about guys in prison. And in their specific situation, they were talking about the hope that they could experience. Now, my idea of hope doesn't match up with the Greeks' idea of hope. Doesn't match up with the idea of hope in The Shawshank Redemption. And I'm glad about that. Because you know what? Hope can be a dangerous thing, but it can also be a wonderful thing. So what makes my hope, and hopefully your hope, different from the hope in the movie, or the hope that Pandora left in the box? Last week, if you were here, you were lucky enough to hear from a special guest speaker. Peter was here and talked to you guys. Now, I missed it. I was late, and I just ran into him as he was leaving. We crossed paths right out there at the back door. He was in a hurry. He had to get somewhere. So I don't know. But we crossed paths at the back door, and just got to exchange a few words with him and didn't really get to hear what he had to say. So I decided this week to go and find out, what's this Peter guy got to say? What's he all about? So I looked in the Bible and found the first letter that he wrote, the book 1 Peter. And if we start there, we look in verse 3 of chapter 1, the book of 1 Peter. It says, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In His great mercy, He has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade, kept in heaven for you, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief and all kinds of trials. These have come so that your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may be proved genuine and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. Though you have not seen Him, you love Him. And even though you do not see Him now, you believe in Him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy. For you are receiving the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls." Peter's idea of hope doesn't really sound like the Greek idea of hope either, or the idea of hope that we find in The Shawshank Redemption. His hope sounds like a good thing. It sounds like a great thing. So what's different about his hope? First of all, if we read in verse 3, it says, "He has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead." Peter's hope is a hope that lives. And why does it live? Because it's based on a living God. It's not based on some God that's mortal and lives up on top of a mountain and throws lightning bolts at us. That's the Greeks' God. That's not our God. That's not the living God. Zeus never came down from the mountaintop and died for the people and then came back to life. Zeus would never do that. He was more interested in what he wanted than what was good for the people. It says that we are born again into a living hope. What does that mean, a living hope? What does it mean that something is alive? I used to have fish. I had 3 goldfish that girls in the Sunday school class I was teaching bought for me. And luckily, Carl didn't know this when he asked me to watch his fish when he was out of town this summer. But I wasn't real good at taking care of those goldfish. In fact, I'd feed them and look at them and tap on the glass once in a while, and that was about it. I not really a pet kind of person. The only indication that I had that those goldfish were alive were that they were active. That's the only way that I knew that anything was going on. And that's the only way that I knew that they were dead, was when they stopped moving. I don't know anything about goldfish. I tried to find stuff out, but I don't know. And that's the thing about things that are living, like our hope. Being alive means we have the chance to be active. And a living hope is active. Peter's hope is active. What do I mean by that? It's kind of like the difference between wishing and praying. I can hope that it's not going to rain tomorrow because I've had plenty of rain. Do I have any confidence that it's not going to rain tomorrow? Is there anyone out there who's going to step in on my behalf and make it not rain tomorrow? The weatherman certainly doesn't seem to think so. He thinks it's going to rain again tomorrow. And if I wish that it's not going to rain tomorrow, chances are it's still going to rain. And wishing is just kind of passive. You say, I wish. Or at most, you hold a birthday cake in front of you and try to blow out all the candles. But when you're making that wish there, are you making the wish to the candles? Are those candles going to come and help you out? Now, prayer, on the other hand. I don't know about you, but when I pray, it's a lot different than when I'm blowing out the candles on a birthday cake, or than when I see a shooting star or pull the right side of a wishbone. Because a prayer isn't just something that happens like this and passes. A prayer is something that I work on. Prayer is something that kind of sticks with you. Like when you get something stuck in your teeth and you keep playing with it and you can't get rid of it. That's what a real prayer is. Something that's there that you're dealing with. Not just when you get up in the morning, not just when you pray at church, not just before you go to bed at night, but a prayer is something that you're struggling with all day. From the moment you get up until the moment when you go to sleep. It's there, and you're working on it. And you say, God, this is bothering me. This is important. This is something that I need your help with. It's active. Just like our hope is active. And also, our hope is living. Peter says that our hope comes through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. He goes on to say, into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade, kept in heaven for you, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. I love this part of this passage. Because what it's saying there is that we have hope, that not only is our hope active, we have hope in an active God. And what's he doing? He's shielding us by his power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. Doesn't that make you feel good to know that God's power is shielding us from whatever's out there? That it'll, what he's promising us will never perish, it will never spoil, it will never fade. Think about all those things in your life that you've spent time on, that you've spent money on. And what do? They spoil, or they perish, or they fade. Good luck finding anything on this earth that's not going to perish or spoil or fade. Our hope won't. God's love won't, because it's a living hope. In verse 6, Peter goes on. He says, in this way you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. Our hope here, Peter tells us, it also survives and carries us through hard times. Now, when Peter wrote this, Peter was writing, but he had a secretary with him that kind of helped him out. Peter was just a fisherman. That's basically all he knew. He wasn't a scholar. He wasn't a great writer, so he got a secretary named Silvanus to help him write this so that he could write it down in a way that people would understand it. And for that reason, the book of 1 Peter has some of the best Greek in the entire New Testament. It just flows very nicely and runs very nicely. It's written very well. And Silvanus, when he helped Peter write this, also helped him make things a little easier to swallow. Listen to what we just read there. It says, "Though now, for a little while, you may have had to suffer grief and all kinds of trials." Now, here, it can be a little misleading. He says, "You may have had to suffer in trials." I don't know if I completely agree with that "may," because you know what? I have suffered in trials. I have been through hard times. Have you been through hard times? Who here has been through hard times? Hard times. Everybody. Everyone here has been through hard times. And if you didn't have your hand up, Jim wants to talk to you later about honesty. Silvanus and Peter say here, "You may have to suffer grief and all kinds of trials." I want to tell you that you're going to have hard times. He says they may have come already. If they haven't come already, they will be coming soon. He also says, "For a little while." That little while is important, because a lot of times we can forget about that little while. That little while to us starts to seem like all the time. Starts to seem like constantly. Starts to seem like we're always in those hard times. And sometimes it can seem that way. Remember what we saw in the first point. See, Peter here isn't just talking about right now. He's talking about eternity. He says that our hope will never perish, will never spoil, will never fade. And when he says never there, he's not just talking about the 70 or 80 years, 90 years that we'll be on this earth. He's talking never. When you compare that to a little while of just the few years that we're here, you start to understand where Peter's coming from. But what about these trials? What about these hard times? Why are they there? If we go on in verse 7, Peter says, "These have come so that your faith may be proved genuine and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed." And he has a little parenthetical phrase in there if you're reading along. You see that I skipped over it. In the NIV, it's separated by dashes. And inside that parenthetical phrase, it says, and it's talking about your faith here, it says, "of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire." What's he talking about here? About our faith being of greater worth than gold. And why is he talking about fire? When a jeweler or a blacksmith wants to take a metal like gold and make it pure, what they do is they'll put it in a little bowl, a crucible, and hold it over a fire. And what happens is that metal gets so hot that the imperfections that are in there, the dirt and the non-gold parts that are in there, burn up. The gold itself melts, but those other parts, they burn off and they're released, or they float to the top and you can scoop it out. And Peter says, just like that, your faith is made pure. But gold still perishes, still spoils, and still fades. Your faith does not. And he says that those hard times that we go through are just like that jeweler heating up the gold to make it pure. And we're going to have hard times. But Our faith means that we don't have to perish like gold does. But we're still going to go through the hard times. And God's going to see how we respond. Does that mean that God's going to test us? Yes. He showed us that He's going to do that in His Word. He tested Abraham. He said, Abraham, I gave you this son, Isaac. Now I want you to march up that mountain and sacrifice him to me. What? You want me to do what? But I've waited so long for this son. But Abraham did it. God tested David. He put him on a rooftop and showed him a beautiful woman, Bathsheba, bathing. And David looked down and said, sorry, God. Abraham passed. David failed. Did God love David less than he loved Abraham? No. Did God work in David's life to remedy that problem? To clean off that imperfection? Absolutely. So much so that, as we talked about before, David was a man after God's own heart. And God said that, even though he failed this test. And you know what? We're going to go through tests as well. And during those times, it's important to have hope, or to cling to hope, to hold on to hope, to not let your hope fail. All these things that you've heard people say before, but I want to tell you something else. Then in hard times, for you or for other people, we can't just hold on to hope or not let go of hope. We have to be hope. We have to give hope. I said before that all of us go through hard times. And as many of you know, I was planning to be married 2 weeks ago. And as most of you know, I don't have a ring on my hand. Hard times. Lots of things going on that I thought would never happen to me, that I thought I would never go through. And there were times when I lost hope. When it seemed like there was nowhere to go from where I was. When it seemed like everything that I'd wanted suddenly was upside down. I didn't have any hope left. But luckily, and I thank God, that I had friends who did have hope. Friends who were hope for me. And friends who gave me hope, who reminded me what real hope is. They reminded me about living hope, about hope that will survive and carry us through those hard times. I want to tell you that if you've got friends, if you've got people that you care about, and I pray to God that each one of you here today does, there are going to be times when those people don't have hope. When those people who you care about don't have anything in them to give them hope. And that's when it's your job to be there for them, to be hope for them, to show them what hope really is. Peter goes on in verse 8. And he says, though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy. For you are receiving the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls. The last thing about hope is that hope is fulfilled with joy and salvation. Joy that can only come from having hope. There's a preacher that I like to listen to. His name is Ravi Zacharias. And he says, in many different times, he says, for the unbeliever, sorrow is central and joy is peripheral. For the Christian, joy is central and sorrow is peripheral. Now what he's saying there is that if you're not a Christian, You're going to go through life probably sorry and filled with sorrow most of the time. You'll have moments where things seem good. And you'll have moments where you feel on top of the world. You'll have moments of joy. And you'll look back on those moments and say, you know, that was a great time. You'll find that most of the time, you're looking back. If you're a Christian, however, you're going to have a life that's filled with joy. A joy that comes from a living hope. Because we're not going to be looking back. We're going to be looking forward. Living hope, that means we have joy with only brief times of despair. And during those times, we're not looking back at the times of joy we've had before. We're looking forward to the time when we'll know nothing but joy. Times when those sorrows seem so far behind us. Times when we don't even remember the times of sorrow. We're just waiting for the next moment of joy. And that comes from hope. From a hope that lives and is based on a living God. From hope that survives and carries us through those hard times. And from hope that can only be found in a living God who loves us and who cares for us. We started off with a movie, with a clip from the movie The Shawshank Redemption. And in that movie, Tim Robbins' character, who we saw talking, he was the Caucasian gentleman. In the movie, he's thrown in jail with a life sentence, but he's innocent. And when he's thrown in jail, they take away everything from him. They take his life, his success, his money, his freedom. And he realizes, and he starts telling people in the scene that we saw, that the only thing he has left is hope. And throughout the course of the movie, he fights to hold on to that hope. And at the same time, while he's doing that, he also starts to be hope and to give hope to other people. And we find out later on that Morgan Freeman, who we also saw in that clip, gets to a point where he's out of hope. And it's for a strange reason, because he's just been released from prison, where he's been for over half of his life, and that's all that he knew. And when he gets out, he finds out that he has nothing to hope for. He contemplates committing a crime so that he'll be sent back into prison, back to something that he knows. But then he remembers his friend. And he remembers the hope that he was given from that friend. And hopefully this clip will work so we can see what happens.
I find I'm so excited I can barely sit still or hold a thought in my head. I think it's the excitement only a free man can feel. A free man at the start of a long journey whose conclusion is uncertain. I hope I can make it across the border. I hope to see my friend and shake his hand. I hope the Pacific is as blue as it has been in my dreams. I hope.
Why does he hope? What's different now than was before? Why can we have hope? Unlike the Greeks and unlike they had early in this movie, because we know that tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow is going to be better than today. Because we know that in the end, we're going to wind up in a paradise that's better than where those two guys were. Because we have a God who loves us. Not one who punishes us with eagles and lightning bolts. One who loves us enough to send his son to die, to go through those same hard times that we go through. And a God that's powerful enough to overcome them. We have a hope that's more than just wishes. We have a hope that lasts through the hard times. And we have a hope that gives us and leads to joy. And this morning, I know that hope can be a hard thing to see, a hard thing to hold on to. Jim's going to come forward and lead us in our closing song, and I want each of you to be challenged today to hold on to hope, to remember the source of our hope, and also to look around and see those people that need hope, that don't have any hope, and to be hope for them. Give hope to them. You might not think you're doing a good enough job, or might not even realize that you're doing it at the time, but just being there for them in those hard times, just letting them know that you love them, will do more for them than you could ever imagine. Because it'll give back their hope.
Stand, please. If you're one of those persons here today without hope, you can take care of that right now just by coming forward as we sing this hymn of decision. Won't you come as we sing?